I'm going to be covering a lot of the tremendous successes that we've seen with our has been shown with surveillance for vaccine preventable diseases, some of the challenges, and then I'll be giving examples from the two vaccine programs with the diseases listed here, intermediately implemented vaccine programs, and then finally end with some of the new vaccine programs and surveillance that's planned or underway for those diseases. The tremendous successes for our vaccine programs are shown here in disease data reported to the National Notifiable Disease Surveillance System, showing tremendous declines in disease ranging from 92% for pertussis to 100% for smallpox, diphtheria, and paralytic polio. For more recently implemented programs, a lot of these are estimates because there's no national reporting for some of these diseases. But again, we see significant declines for everything with the exception of influenza mortality. So let's go on to discuss some of the diseases one by one, starting with pertussis. Two MMWRs over the last couple of years highlighting outbreaks for pertussis. I know a lot of you have been very busy with outbreaks at the state level, as has CDC at the national level. This is because there's been an increase in pertussis over the last 20 years, a slow increase in number of reported cases, also in incidence. And this increase, as you see here, and as you probably know from this state, is occurring mainly in adolescents and adults. Whether this is a real increase or an artifact of increased reporting and awareness of pertussis or increased availability of new testing for pertussis, mainly PCR as a new tool, has been much debated and discussed. But I think the consensus opinion is that it is, represents at least partially a true increase in cases, and this is because we also see an increase in pertussis deaths. And those deaths occur predominantly in children 0 and 1 month of age. So they're tragic, they cannot be prevented by vaccination in the infant schedule, and these children are getting infected from the adolescent and young adults primarily. The strategy to prevent these deaths, of course, is DTaP, and we hope in a few years with greater use of this vaccine in adolescents and adults that pertussis deaths in infants will decrease as well. Going on to measles, some of you may have seen this early release article a couple of weeks ago highlighting an outbreak of measles in San Diego, California. Measles, as you know, is no longer an endemic disease in the United States. Elimination was declared in 2000. That arrow's in the wrong place. Now we have about 50 cases reported a year for measles. They're all related to imported cases, and importations may occur from developed countries as well as developing countries, and we've had a lot of imports this year from Europe. Outbreaks in the last few years have occurred predominantly in unprotected populations. In 2005, a small outbreak of 34 cases in an unvaccinated religious community in Boston. In 2006, 18 cases in young adults, mainly one-dose vaccine recipients and foreign-born adults, and then this year in San Diego. This is the San Diego outbreak, which started from with a 7-year-old unvaccinated child who was unvaccinated due to personal belief exemption. He traveled to Switzerland with his family, came back, had onset of rash, and then there were 2 generations of spread from this case, resulting in 12 cases altogether. This year to date, we've had 21 confirmed measles cases reported so far to NCIRD, the 12-case outbreak in San Diego. There's an outbreak in Arizona, also resulting from an importation from Switzerland, and that's 6 cases and counting. There have been 2 cases of measles in New York City with a genotype D4 isolated, thought to have come in from Israel, but no definite links yet. And then a case of measles into Virginia in a 15-month-old unvaccinated child who traveled with his family to India. 17 of these 21 cases have been greater than 12 months and so eligible for vaccination, and none of them have been vaccinated. I just remind you to maintain a high index of suspicion for measles in persons who travel or those who are in contact with travelers. Going on to mumps, I'm sure all of you in this room were aware or working on the mumps outbreak that occurred in the United States a couple of years ago. This is the epicurve for the outbreak in 2006. So I guess the big question is what's happened since. We see that before the outbreak, we had very low number of cases reported, less than 300 a year, or about 26 or 28 a month. Then we had this big outbreak in 2006 when 6,500 odd cases were reported. Since then, probably due to increased heightened surveillance, we're having about 60 cases a month of mumps reported. The age-specific incidence patterns have changed quite a lot during the outbreak. Pre-outbreak, the highest incidence was in 5 to 9-year-olds, followed by 1 to 4-year-olds. Incidence increased in all age groups during the outbreak, but the peak incidence was in 18 to 24-year-olds, and 80% or more of those cases had 2 doses of MMR vaccine. After the outbreak, the age-specific patterns have changed again, with, again, predominantly affecting under 10s, although young adults also have a higher incidence than they did previously. This year, we have had some small clusters in college campuses that we worry about and watch very closely, and we've had an increased number of sporadic cases reported from Maine, Michigan, and American Samoa. Just to remind you that this year there are changes to the case definition and case classifications for mumps. Probable cases now require an EpiLink. Reporting to NNDSS of some key surveillance variables is incomplete, and we urge, now that the cases are down to a manageable level again, to try to complete these key variables, especially vaccination status, or we can't tell if the cases are due to program failure or vaccine failure. Also, information on transmission setting and lab testing. In vaccinated cases, one of the challenges has been a lower confirmation rate using the standard sort of methods that we use to confirm cases. And so the CSTE statement from last year did state that we can't rule out a case if the lab testing is negative. Testing for other viral causes of parotiditis may help rule in other diagnoses if mumps testing is negative. On to Hib, as Bill mentioned, there have been shortages of Hib vaccine, which is why I'm including this slide today. Hib is a very rare disease in the United States due to an extremely successful vaccine and vaccination program. Because of that, though, and down to very low numbers of disease, serotyping of all HI cases in children less than 5 is increasingly important, due to this program success, but also because of the vaccine supply issues and temporary deferral of the booster dose. Hepatitis B, very successful vaccination program also, with a 97 and 98% decline in hepatitis B cases in those under 20 since the vaccine was introduced in 1991, and a 76% decline in cases over 20. I didn't have time to show other slides that I would have liked to have shown with Hep B, showing the declines and closing gaps, racial and ethnic gaps as well. Now that the cases are down to very low numbers in the 0 to 18-year-old age group, there's a plea to try to collect better vaccination status on these cases, which should be quite manageable because the numbers are now very small. In the last 3 years, 186 cases are reported in this age group, but unfortunately, for 75% of those cases, we don't have vaccination status information. It's important to collect this information to be able to differentiate between vaccine failure and program failure. If the child is vaccinated, we want to know, did the child receive all of the required doses according to the recommended schedule, and at what age were they vaccinated? If the child is not vaccinated, we'd like to know why not and what opportunities might have been missed to vaccinate and protect that child. Hepatitis A, also a huge success story. Over the 10 years of implementation of this program, we see the map of hepatitis A incidence during the time period 10 years before implementation of the program first in 1996. Now, in 2006, essentially all those colors have gone, and hepatitis incidence is down to extremely low rates across the country. As you know, there was incremental implementation of this program, starting with the high incident states in 1996, the intermediate incident states in 1999, and then in 2006, a universal recommendation with vaccination at age one. You see here the tremendous declines in disease percents here, 88 to 93% in these three age groups with implementation of this program. Here I do show the tremendous achievements also in closing the gaps in incidents that were really large before in across the different racial and ethnic groups, with particularly high rates in American Indian and Alaskan Natives, and as you can see now, no gaps at all. So a tremendous success story. Varicella and herpes zoster. Varicella deaths became reportable as the first stage of national surveillance for varicella in 2000. I think any deaths that occur due to varicella in this era are sentinel events for program failure. And here are two examples. A 10-year-old healthy female who was unvaccinated, developed encephalitis and died. Her likely source of transmission was an ongoing varicella outbreak at her school. Here's a healthy 13-month-old, and although this child fits right into the recommended age, and so it wasn't of 12 to 15 months for the first dose, so from that perspective may not be considered a program failure, you'll see from this history that she got varicella from her father, and so she could have in fact been given post-exposure varicella vaccine within 3 to 5 days, and it may have considerably modified this disease. So both these cases are just tragic reminders and should serve as sentinel events of program failure. Going on to varicella cases, we've had active surveillance in two sites now for 12 years or 13 years, and we see over the time period in both Antelope Valley, California and West Philadelphia, tremendous decline in varicella cases, although that decline has sort of evened off and flattened out in most recent years. Nevertheless, that decline does translate into a decline in incidence of 90% in both sites, with declines in all age groups, including children under one, who are considerably protected by indirect vaccination effects. If we look at state data, and this is passive surveillance data reported to NNDSS from three states that have been consistently high reporters or consistent reporters over this 16-year time period, we also see substantial impact of the varicella vaccination program, which started in 1995, with a 94% decline in Illinois, less of a decline, but still substantial in these other two states, Michigan and West Virginia. When we talked to them about why the cases went up in 2006, they pointed out that this was due to enhancing surveillance as they moved to case-based surveillance. Herpes zoster surveillance is important for two reasons. The first reason is surveillance for monitoring the impact of the varicella vaccine on herpes zoster epidemiology. And from that perspective, we've seen no consistent trends in herpes zoster since 1995. In vaccinated cohorts or children under 10, herpes zoster appears to be decreasing. In cohorts with vaccine varicella history, there are inconsistent findings. Some studies show a stable incidence and others show an increasing incidence. So we need to keep watching this for longer. The second reason to be doing surveillance for herpes zoster is, of course, it's a new vaccine. And so I'm sticking it in here rather than at the end of the presentation. A zoster vaccine was recommended for healthy people over 60 in 2006. And we, at the national level, we're beginning surveillance for monitoring that program impact. In active surveillance sites for varicella, we've added herpes zoster in those older than 60. And over the years, with experience of monitoring herpes zoster for monitoring the varicella program, we've used some of these different survey methods and administrative databases. And so hope in the next few years to get that going in a greater to a greater extent. On to influenza-associated pediatric mortality surveillance. This was the first influenza condition to become nationally notifiable. Surveillance for influenza is challenging, but pediatric deaths are nationally notifiable, and this surveillance was implemented following the severe influenza season of 2003 and 4, where a lot of children were noted to die from influenza. Over the following three seasons, you see that 47, 46, and 73 confirmed pediatric deaths have been reported with median age and characteristics as noted here. Another thing that's been noted in these pediatric deaths is the increase in invasive bacterial infection, especially Staph aureus, over the 3 years. And so the summary of the 3 years of experience with reporting of pediatric deaths for flu is that the influenza was rapidly fatal in these children. Almost half of them died within 3 days of onset, and almost half of them died at home or in the emergency department. The vaccination rates were very low in those with an ACIP indication. And then the co-infection with Staph aureus increased dramatically over the 3 years. It's not sure exactly why that occurred and whether or not it's an artifact of reporting, but this is something that will be watched increasingly as this surveillance progresses. On to invasive pneumococcal disease. If you start with a great vaccine like this one is, and these are the post-licensure vaccine effectiveness results published in Lancet in late 2006, showing that for the serotypes covered in the vaccine in healthy children, this vaccine prevents 96% of invasive pneumococcal disease with greater than or equal to one dose, and for those with an underlying illness, 81%, and then these are serotype-specific vaccine effectiveness estimates. Some of you may have seen these data from previous years, but down now to 2006, we see a 99% decline in disease, invasive pneumococcal disease in children under five, and then for all serotypes, a 76% decline in disease. So extremely impressive impact from this vaccine. Along with this impact, we're seeing an increase in serotype 19A, that's increasing here in the green line. And so this has been considered, I think, as a replacement phenomenon to at least an extent. You see the incidence is still low, but it is something that we'll be watching closely over the coming years. The other extremely good news from vaccinating children is the tremendous impact of herd immunity protection of adults. Shown here that for every adult age group, 18 up to those over 80, there's been an 84% or higher decline in disease in this age group. I mean, this is a real success story. Just for you to be aware that a 13-valent vaccine is in development, that state surveillance for invasive pneumococcal disease in children is important for monitoring the continued impact of the current vaccine, for monitoring replacement serotypes and the impact of new vaccine development when this vaccine becomes available, we hope, in a few years. There's a new PCR-based approach to serotyping that is available to all state labs. The protocol is available at this website, and the CDC Streptococcal Lab is available to provide technical assistance. And lastly, monitoring two of the new vaccine programs, starting with rotavirus. National surveillance for cases are impractical at this stage of the vaccination program. There are about 3 million cases of rotavirus disease annually, and lab testing is required to confirm the diagnosis, so it's a little challenging to do national surveillance. Components of rotavirus surveillance at the moment are strain surveillance through the National Respiratory and Enteric Virus Surveillance System, that about 100 labs throughout the country are sending strains to CDC where strain typing is done. And so that'll sort of give us an indication of strains that are circulating around the country as the vaccine is introduced and used. And then surveillance is providing some focused efforts to evaluate vaccine impact on severe disease and viral strains at sentinel sites, the New Vaccine Surveillance Network, which is the University of Rochester, Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and Vanderbilt University. And these, in the counties that these three universities serve, there's population-based surveillance. For rotavirus, this system had been used for flu in children under five for quite some years, but it started for rotavirus in January 2006. Children with acute gastroenteritis are enrolled and stool specimens tested for rotavirus. These are the results of the first season of data collection, which are considered pre-vaccine. We see that 50% of the acute gastroenteritis cases that were hospitalized were positive for rotavirus, 50% of those that presented in the emergency department, and 29% of those who came to outpatient clinics. And these are the serotypes, strain types, that were identified from those specimens. Another way of monitoring the impact of the rotavirus program is going to be looking at national hospitalized data, where you see the very nice seasonality of diarrhea in general that mainly reflects the seasonality of rotavirus diarrhea. And there's ongoing efforts to look at these data in an effort to demonstrate impact of the vaccine, which we suspect may be possible by next year. Finally, HPV. There are a lot of challenges and opportunities for monitoring this vaccine program. There's two types of HPV, 16 and 18, that cause cervical cancer, precancer, and abnormal PAPs. Two types in the Merck vaccine, 6 and 11, that cause genital warts and recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. Time between infection and outcomes is only months for warts, but it's years to decades for cervical cancer. The surveillance involves interfaces with cervical cancer screening and new collaborations between immunization, STD, and cancer. The natural history of HPV infection and cervical cancer goes for decades, and the surveillance that's planned and is getting in place now covers all time periods in this natural history, from isolation of HPV at an early stage to looking at abnormal at SIN at different times, and then cervical cancer many decades later. Cancer surveillance in the United States is done now through the National Program of Cancer Registries, and 100% of the population is covered, and so this is a very, very useful source of surveillance for cervical cancer. So to monitor the impact of the HPV program in the United States for cervical cancer, there are the established cancer registries, and HPV typing is to be initiated at several of these sites. There's the precancerous lesions that I mentioned, SIN 2 and 3, and there are Sentinel projects initiated to collect population-based data on this and also administrative data. For genital warts, there's some surveillance that started in STD clinics, and then there's type-specific HPV prevalence studies being done through NHANES. To conclude then, disease surveillance is essential for demonstrating the impact of vaccines, for guiding vaccine policy and programs. Disease surveillance data also provides critical data for monitoring effectiveness of vaccines. You all do all the work out there. We thank you for your work, and I'd like to thank a number of people that provided me slides. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Atkinson and Seward. We have a few minutes for questions, so please go to one of the microphones. I think they're microphones. Yeah, they're microphones.
Thank you for the presentation. My name is John Corey. I'm from West Virginia. I have a question about HPV. If the third dose is given less than 24 weeks after the first dose, after March 5th, the recommendation is to give an additional dose. The question is, when do we give that dose?
The general recommendations provides our guidance on that, and according to the 2006 general recommendations, when there is an invalid dose because of an interval or age violation, that the repeat dose should be given a minimum interval after the invalid dose. Therefore, the repeat dose of HPV vaccine, if the interval is too short for dose 3, should be given 12 weeks after the invalid dose, assuming that at least 24 weeks have passed since the first dose.
Rosemary, Vandenberg County Health Department, Indiana. Dr. Atkinson, for years we've taken great pleasure in giving a whopping dose of IG to our foreign travelers that call us at the last minute going to Ethiopia and have had no vaccines in their lifetime. We do recognize now that the first initial dose of Hep A is considered adequate coverage. My question is, since we have initiated then those new guidelines, we are no longer giving, I won't say no longer giving, but as far as twin RICs, what we have done then is educated the client and separated the A and B so that the A would be sufficient for them, and then go ahead and start their B separate also, even though we know they're not going to get coverage for the Hep B. Would that be your suggestion? I mean, you know, they're leaving in 10 days, so we have to cover the A. The B we can't cover anyway, so instead of giving twin RICs, we're giving them separate. What do you think?
I think if you have an impending departure, that probably using a single adult dose of hepatitis A vaccine, you get a little higher sewer conversion.
Yeah.
Within a month after a regular adult dose rather than the functionally the half dose in twin RICs.
Yeah.
So if you have time, so I think it would be definitely beneficial to use the single dose of adult hepatitis A vaccine. So I'd agree with your strategy.
Okay. And also then that recommendation of using the Hep A vaccine rather than the IG. Where is that written so that we could,
Sure. It was in that October 19th MMWR article.
Okay.
All those, both the post-exposure prophylaxis recommendations and the travel, yes, international travel guidelines were both in that same document. I'd be happy to send you the reference
okay.
if you need it.
Thank you.